The show serves in the public's interest, and SMG reserves the right to maintain control of the show as to keep within the guidelines of the FCC.
If you have any comments or complaints, you can contact SMG.
At SMG, we strive to present the best product we can. We value your opinion, and we thank you so much for listening and tuning in to News Talk K57.
Sharpen the tools in your shed. Your talk, your station, News Talk K57.
Good evening, and it's another Tuesday evening, which means it's time for the Data Hub of Tyrone Titchener. I'm Tyrone Titchener, the Director of the Bureau of Statistics and Plans. Thank you for joining us. Tonight, after the 7 o'clock news, we'll have Dr. Yvette Polino, Associate Professor of Health and Science, Health Sciences, and Dr. Grajna Badowski, Associate Professor of Mathematics from the University of Guam, to discuss their work on what is known as a Social Vulnerability Index, a project they're doing in which the Bureau is supporting with its own data to help in the work. So they're going to discuss with us what does it mean to have a Social Vulnerability Index and what its implications is for a community. But first up, we're going to have Chief Dan Stone from the Guam Fire Department, who would discuss the latest capital acquisitions to the fire department's public safety capital rolling stock, and particularly with respect to emergency services. For anyone who wants to join the conversation, you can call in at 477-5757, 477-5757. We are broadcast live on News Talk K57 and on 96.5 FM. And we're streaming live on pncguam.com, on k57.com, and we are simulcast on GTA Channel 3 and Docomo Channel 2. And a podcast of tonight's show will be posted on k57.com later this evening. And over the next few days, it will be posted on the Bureau of Statistics and Plans' 3 social media pages on Facebook, one for the Bureau itself, one for the Coral Reef Initiative, and a third for the Guam Coastal Management Program. Next week, we'll have on David De La Sola, Director of the Department of Labor, who will give us the latest update on what's happening in PUA checks, particularly with the passage and enactment into law of the American Recovery Plan, one pushed through by the Biden administration with the support of Democrats. And that, in addition to the PUA checks, over the next couple weeks, we're going to be examining a number of other measures coming out with a direct impact on the island, in particular for a large tranche of funding to support increased vaccinations. As you know, today is the, some of you have heard, today is the start when the eligibility was lowered to age 16. And certainly encourage any of you out there who have not yet get vaccinated. My wife and I have gotten vaccinated so far, but please take advantage of this opportunity to get the vaccinations. It's important not only for the safety and health of you and your family, but also for the recovery of this island for the economic dislocations from COVID-19. And as I mentioned, joining us is Chief Dan Stone of the Guam Fire Department. Chief Stone, how are you doing tonight?
Good evening, Ty. How are you?
Doing okay, you know. He's still up and around and still doing the show. But thanks for joining us. And I asked Chief Stone to join us because of under his leadership, the Guam Fire Department has made a number of important milestones. And one of them was the acquisition of 7 brand new ambulances last year. And just this month, they're acquiring 2 more ambulances. Chief Stone, how many ambulances are normally out in service during a normal shift of the ambulance service, the Guam Fire Department?
Right. So appreciate the question, Ty. And so actually, coincidentally, the amount of ambulances that we have online at any given day is seven.
Is seven. And now you have nine brand new ambulances for the fleet, in addition to the other older ambulances. What is the, maybe give a sketch here, what are the implications of having that expanded rolling stock of brand new vehicles for the ambulance service? What does that mean for their ambulance service itself and its reliability?
Yeah, I will tell you, Ty, that with the arrival of the seven ambulances last year, through considerable help with the governor's office and, of course, your office and then BBMR and all the people that are instrumental in making these kind of purchases happen, was a huge shot in the arm of GFD as far as our ambulance fleet's concerned. Because as you and I discussed when I first approached you about this, was that we do have an aging fleet in the Guam Fire Department, both in our ambulances and even on our fire our fire trucks. Mm-hmm. And so definitely something that we want to be able to address. And we were absolutely able to address with the purchase of those seven ambulances. The two additional ambulances that we're expecting here any time now, again, is just adding to the inventory so that we can be able to take those ambulances that have either met their service life or probably could use some additional or some maintenance. Gives us that opportunity to take them offline, provide the maintenance, and or retire the older fleet.
And this lack of expanded opportunity to regularly scheduled maintenance is important for the ambulance service itself. I mean, you and I, probably you recall these stories even better than I do of a number of ambulances on the road dropping down to four. And it wasn't because the fire department didn't have the ambulances, but they were all in a state of disrepair, so they couldn't be put into service. And what contributes to that mechanical difficulties of the ambulance fleet of the fire department is not only that it's an aging fleet, but the fact is that when given those exigencies and the demand for services, you were kind of running, the fire department was forced in the position of running them nonstop, 24 hours a day, and not having a chance to take them offline to do the preventive maintenance that would keep it extend its life of a given ambulance there. So I'm thinking that with nine brand new ambulances, you're able to extend the life of the ambulance of the existing ambulances and their reliability to maintenance breakdowns. Because given the continuous demand you have in your business, Chief Stone, for emergency services, it's that long haul. I'm thinking is the real thing to focus in on, as opposed to the individual emergency and maintaining of that service, particularly ambulance services, which people so vitally depend upon. Do I have that as sort of a, is that a fair assessment of the situation?
No, you're actually very spot on, Ty. So you definitely have a good pulse as to what our needs are and what takes place in the Guam Fire Department. So, obviously the ambulances need to be available 24/7, 365, and that's exactly the type of service we provide to our communities. And you don't schedule emergencies, so you're right. The challenge was not being able to have that reserve fleet, at least a couple of ambulances in reserve, to be able to have that rotation and get the maintenance that is required of these vehicles. And as you indicated, we're on the road 24/7. So the mileage that we accrue with these vehicles can be very, very high. And if we can't get them offline to provide the important maintenance, we only compound the problem. Something that would be a small fix winds up being a bigger fix because of that. And so with the addition of these new ambulances, that provides us that opportunity to schedule the maintenance accordingly so that we can prolong the life of the fleet.
Yeah, I the reason why I have this sort of perspective is that in a previous incarnation, I was general manager of the Guam Mass Transit Authority. So I understand the importance of not having also available rolling stock to service routes or given hours, but having a depth of capacity in rolling stock that contributes to the reliability and also the extended lifespan of individual vehicles, whether it be buses or ambulances. And the more you have, the more you get on the road. Chief Stone, can I ask a question? Are you still doing the COVID-19 cleaning after every ambulance that was that you had to implement early last year? Is that still going on with the ambulance fleet?
Absolutely, Ty. You know, that is one of the key points of our successes during our pandemic response and the continued response that we have now, is that because after each run, we actually were able to form, you know, take some of our rank and file and create a decon team that was their sole purpose is once the ambulances arrive to the treatment facilities, mm-hmm. And we're doing patient transfer into the ER, mm-hmm. That decon crew would go on to the ambulances and start immediately performing the decon necessary to minimize the downtime of that ambulance. Because early on, when the ambulance crews themselves were taking care of the decon, we could have that ambulance basically out of service for anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour. Just because they have to do their patient transfer, then go back out, and you know, of course, they had to decontaminate the ambulance, and then they had to decontaminate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
When we added the decon team in, that was happening simultaneously as the medics were inside doing patient transfer. The decon crews were taking care of the decon of the ambulance, so that by the time the crews came out, they were ready to take that next call. That particular process, that protocol is definitely one of the major factors to our success in keeping our positivity rate within the Guam Fire Department fairly low. That doesn't mean that we went without some positives, and we did, but we were able to keep that fairly low given the amount of patients that we were transporting during that peak periods and even up till now. So. That was the long answer to the short question, so I apologize.
Well, no, yes. It's okay. I'm glad you fully explained to it, because the one reason I raise this to, and this is in part to give the listening audience the insight as to how these capital acquisition decisions are made. The reason why the Bureau was involved in the ambulance acquisition business with the fire department is because last year the Bureau received a substantial Department of Justice grant to aid in the effort to combat COVID-19. And as part of that process, we consulted with frontline agencies like the fire department and Chief Dan Stone, and so they had discussions as to what do you really need. And in part, in addition to ambulances to replace a aging fleet that was on the verge of complete breakdown for many of those vehicles here, you also looked at creative ways to, as we like to put it, like false multipliers. And as part of the capital rolling stock acquisition, we utilized the grant to get two command vehicles for the fire department, and this is what they're using for the decontaminations after each run at the medical facilities after each run of the ambulances. Isn't that correct, Chief Stone?
Well, so actually, the command vehicles, just to kind of clarify, well, the command vehicles are definitely, that's another vehicle acquisition that we're mm-hmm. we're very happy that we're going to be able to avail ourselves of. And again,
it adds to the non-ambulance, right?
The governor, of course, you know, making sure that she, you know, when we present our needs, that she places the priority on those needs, you know, and so very appreciative of that. And so the command vehicles, so again, Ty, it goes back to being able to replace an aged fleet, and our command vehicles that are out there. I think our newest one, and don't hold me to this, I think our the newest command vehicle that we have is a 2009. So you can see that we've been able to maintain that fleet and gotten absolutely every mile that we can out of it. But they've come to a point where,
right.
Again, maintenance has become the challenge.
And of course, those vehicles are used for broad array of purposes. But the point I was making, in the process of improving ambulance services, non-ambulance vehicles have a role to play in that it accelerated the turnaround time. Which quite often, when ambulances deposit their patients at a acute care facility, any one of the two hospitals, they get the call and quickly have to turn around. So they don't have time to go back to the station, in which case they're bringing the crews to the site helps the turnaround time. Do I have that part right, Chief Stone?
So yes, you're correct. We do have a whole bunch of vehicles. Well, not a whole bunch. That's not a correct statement at all.
You have a lot more than you did before.
They're available to be able to facilitate those, because you're right. There is always that potential for having multiple ambulances at both facilities.
Right.
And so we basically have to divide and conquer, and then utilize these vehicles to be able to achieve that. And so
right.
So yes, you are right.
Thank you. And we have a caller on the line. Anthony, are you there? You have a question about safety on the roads. Let's see if Anthony, are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, and you have a question for me and Chief Stone.
Yeah,
listen,
Mr. Stone, what's his first name?
His name is Dan Stone. He's chief of the Guam Fire Department.
Oh, okay then. Yeah, this is regarding the safety of our roads here in the island. How many ambulances did the government provide for the fire department as for right now?
As of last year, and this is with a service routes of about seven vehicles on the road at any one time, the acquisition through a number of grants here was seven last year, and there are two more coming on island this month.
And what's the cost of each ambulance?
I'm trying to recall what the cost last year. I think there was maybe roughly in the $150,000, but don't hold me to it. I'd have to go back and check the cost figures. It was about a year ago.
You know, Mr. Stone can, work with the administration of the government now regarding our safety of the roads.
Mm-hmm.
At least one ambulance, instead of the one, they bought seven, at least just buy six and do the safety of the markings of our road.
I understand the concern markings on the road. And before we get to that subject, I think perhaps the fact that Chief Stone and his people have so successfully met the ambulance needs, it may have faded from memory of a lot of us about the headlines of how many ambulances were down and how we only had four ambulances in services and the critical situation that it was affecting people's lives. And so in the process of addressing this vital service here, I kind of not really willing to accept the idea it was an either-or situation. I think the concern you raise about the roads are important and probably and most certainly should be invested as well. But, considering the historical challenges Chief Stone and his colleagues of the fire department have had to address because of the lack of resources to give them the ambulances they need to fully meet the needs of our people.
Yeah, I understand that.
But your point is about the safety of the roads, and then we need to do something about the markings.
If we want to say that the fire department is they play a big part of the safety in the island,
right?
And especially they're running their vehicles on the road and the safety for the people, If public work ain't too concerned about the safety of the road, mm-hmm. then I guess we can adjust it to at least the fire department to the administration. There is money there. Don't tell me there's no money regarding we cannot mark our roads.
Okay, so Anthony, perhaps just to expand on the point, what would you like to see done with the roads? You think there need more reflective markers?
When you're on the traffic light, and it's green, and you're going to go to an intersection, and you're going up, you're going to pass through the traffic light when it's red, you can't even see which lane you're going to go to.
At night?
Even when you're traveling. And then your markings, the yellow markings of the island,
mm-hmm.
those are concerns because it just takes one vehicle to climb it,
mm-hmm.
Go over it, if a person doesn't see it, man, it's mm-hmm. going to cause something really bad.
Are you talking about like a nighttime situation?
About that.
Are you talking about nighttime situations?
Nighttime situations.
No, I tell you what, I kind of identify with your concern. You know, as I'm getting older myself and my night vision is not what it used to be, particularly those when you're at that intersection and particularly to go from where you're at the intersection across the four-way intersection to the next one. And in that middle, there are no trackers. And so you look for the reflectors on the other side. Right, and then that's sometimes a challenge to do. So
it's not visible. Even with the drivers, if the drivers, did you guys ever have a concern with them? Talk to whoever's operating the ambulance. How are they? How is it when they're traveling at a speed and all these things? Did the drivers ever speak about the markings of the condition of the roads as they pursue a rescue?
Well, I think there's a discussion happening amongst many agencies, but the fire department has an important mission to do it. But you raise an important issue that certainly we should raise to people at the Department of Public Works and other agencies. You'd like to see more reflectors on the roads at night.
Yeah,
basically.
It's not that I like to see.
You believe it's important. You believe it's important to have them on the roads at night.
Yeah, but you know, you got all those dying ambulance you guys got, and then you guys are traveling all on the highway speed or whatsoever. People don't know where to go and how to conduct a way for the ambulance to go through. And if there's a miscommunication regarding the markings, because it's going to be the markings for sure. Mm-hmm. You know.
One possible avenue that it might be able to address it this year is that there's working its way through Congress is a what's according to news reports is a $3 trillion infrastructure bill.
There's so much money. We're running out of money. All this pandemic thing and all this crap.
We are.
Did they give us a budget already on the other than the COVID that they're trying to assist us with this pandemic? Did they give us a budget on the government? Spending for all the agencies?
Well, there are actual expenditure reports posted online for all the agencies from whatever funding source here. I think there are a lot of close watch on the federal funds that have come through, both on the administration of Governor Langaro and also on the legislature side. And of course, the one people keep track of all this federal funding are the feds themselves. To make sure it's properly spent, and so because there's with this stuff comes an endless amount of grants reports that have to be filed with respect. I know that my agency deals with a number of these grants myself, and they extend through the life of the grant period. So there's a great deal of scrutiny about the usage of this fund. I think one of the arguments, though, as to why this substantial spending by the federal government is required, it's because we're in the middle of an emergency, and it's like when you have a typhoon. There's no discussion about spending a lot of money in order to recover from the typhoon, and that's sort of the challenge we have with COVID-19. Not to mention to deal with the economic dislocations resulting from COVID-19. So, for that reason alone, I'm having David Elisso, the director of labor, to talk about what additional funding is being made available by the American Rescue Plan enacted by Congress just earlier this month, and what that means for the people and the measure that he's taking with his federal partners to make sure that funding gets out to the people who really need it.
Is that 600 million? Is that just for Guam, or is it for the Mariana Islands?
For Guam.
The Pacific.
For Guam.
That's a lot of money. And then they're what? They're having a hard time with the hospital?
Well, first of all, one of the things that Governor Langaro has said that you should use that $600 million for is to build a new hospital. And so and in terms of the actual operations of the hospital and public health and mental health, which is a partner dealing with the COVID-19, not to mention the other frontline agencies like the fire department here, who have been stretched thin, particularly in the early parts of this crisis. Some of that federal assistance is important to help support that.
What about public health? What about what's going on with the public health? They're still all over the place. They're finding an area to be.
Well, and again, just to look down the path here, there are a couple funding opportunities to build a new public health center. A site has been identified for that in the new hospital along the back road to Anderson. And I said there's according to news reports, a $3 trillion infrastructure bill coming down in addition to the American Rescue Plan out of D.C. later this year. So there are a number of options to actually do build the new public health center. I would have to say Arson Augustine and his crew are doing a bang-up job in helping to run the vaccination centers and helping coordinate that effort along with the National Guard. They've had a lot on their plate during this public health crisis.
Yeah, we even got problems too far. What is it? They want to build a power plant. They want to build a hospital. They want to.
GPA, who gets its revenues not from tax dollars but from our power rates, doesn't appear to have a major problem in funding the new power plant. The controversy with that one had to do with where it's located, and people not necessarily wanted near their own individual homes. But they're moving ahead with their capital investment plans as approved by the Public Utilities Commission, and as supported by our power bills. So, you know, we're going through a major crisis right now, that a healthcare crisis, an economic crisis. But both on both fronts, I think we're making progress to come out of it. We're not out of it yet. but there are massive vaccinations going around. Today they just lowered the eligibility age down to 16. There are, Chief Stone, as we had in the program, there are investments to improve services, particularly for frontline services like the Guam Fire Department. There were a couple, in addition to the ambulances, there were a couple other things I wanted to get with Chief Stone in the remaining 5 minutes of the program, but that might, Chief, that might wait till your next one. I want to talk to you about your new pumper facilities, but that might have to wait to another program.
Well, anyway, if Mr. Stone can really jump the gun with these markings, because if their agency is dealing with safety, so it should start with the roads, because that's where everybody's at, you know.
Well,
that's where everybody's running their vehicles, going to work, trying to make a living. You know, they hit the roads, and then if they don't want to, if the fire department don't want too much casualties in the road, then at least go straight to Lou and see what's going on, if they can help us,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well, that certainly is something Chief Stone and I will take up with the governor's office and with Public Works, because I appreciate your concern about the reflectors at night roads, you know, at night during on our island's roads. Anthony, is there anything else you wanted to bring up while you're on the floor?
That's about it. And what do you call it? I hope Guam gets better in the future. I don't know where all this money's going, and it's not even reaching us, and it's only going to
caller, that's not really true. I mean, there's been broad receipt of the stimulus checks. There's been broad receipt for people who qualify for the PUA checks. There have been investments in not only in the operations to combat COVID-19, but in long-term investments like the ambulances acquired by Chief Stone and his people at the fire department. So, you may argue that there are other areas that need attention, like you mentioned tonight about the reflectors, but I really don't think that it's a fair comment that it's not reaching anybody. It certainly is.
Well, it is, but there's no action. That's why I'm voicing.
Well, on this particular concern about the markers, I appreciate your concern, and it's certainly something I will bring up with Public Works myself as well. The only thing I can point to that perhaps at this stage, because I'm not in charge of the roads either, neither is Dan Stone, is that there is an infrastructure funding bill coming down the pipe from D.C., and perhaps that can be used to address your concern about the reflectors. Okay, Anthony?
Okay.
Well,
you got it all thought down, so we'll go with what your thoughts.
Well, thank you, Anthony. But please call in anytime you like. This has been very interesting and informative. Thanks, Anthony.
All right,
Chief Stone. We are now at near the end of the segment. We're about 2 minutes away from the 7 o'clock CBS Radio News, and so I'd like to turn the. That must be Anthony. Okay, Chief Stone, are you there? Chief Stone, are you there? Okay, I think we have some difficulty. We'll see if we can get Chief Stone on for the last minute. I think Chief Stone may be calling in another line. We'll see what it is. After the 7 o'clock news, which is about a minute and a half, as I said, we're going to have Dr. Yvette Polino, Associate Professor of Health Sciences, and Dr. Grazia Bukowski, Associate Professor of Mathematics, both from the University of Guam. And we're going to talk about their work on a social vulnerability index. We have, is that Chief Stone on the line there? I'm checking with the booth. There's one on. Okay, there we go. I think that then we're about a little bit over a minute on the way to the CBS Radio News at the top of the hour. And after that, we'll come back and talk about a social vulnerability index and what that means for this community. So I'll see you all on the other side.
Sharpen the tools in your shed. Your talk, your station, News Talk, K57. Thinking out loud. Your talk, your station, News Talk, K57.
The views expressed on this show belong to the show host, guests, and callers, and do not represent Sorensen Media Group in any way, shape, or form. This show serves in the public's interest, and SMG reserves the right to maintain control of the show as to keep within the guidelines of the FCC.
If you have any comments or complaints, you can contact SMG.
At SMG, we strive to present the best product we can. We value your opinion, and we thank you so much for listening and tuning in to News Talk K57.
And we're back. This is the Data Hub with Tyrone Titanow. I'm Tyrone Titanow, Director of the Bureau of Statistics and Plans. And coming up, we're going to have a discussion on the Social Vulnerability Index with Dr. Gracia Badosco, Associate Professor of Mathematics at the University of Guam, and her colleague, Dr. Yvette Polino, Associate Professor of Health Sciences. And I believe we have Dr. Polino on the line. Dr. Polino, are you there?
Half a day, Tyrone. Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on this Tuesday evening here. So to start with, why don't we perhaps for the illumination of everybody, and including me to some extent, is why don't you perhaps describe what is meant by social vulnerability index?
Okay, great. So the social vulnerability index is a tool that is used in the natural disaster area as a way to better understand some of the social conditions that could affect a community's ability to respond to some natural hazards, for example, a typhoon, a disease epidemic, or even a chemical spill. So this is a concept that has been around since, I believe, the 1970s, but it wasn't until maybe around 10 years ago that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention developed a model for calculating the Social Vulnerability Index for the United States, the states as well as some of the, I believe it's just Puerto Rico at the moment that they've done this for. So there's a series of variables that are extracted, or data that are extracted from the U.S. Census. that allow for this calculation.
So you in terms of your work, you're confining it out to the model that takes it out of the census data. In reading about this, I was struck by how there are a number of a variety of definitions of a social vulnerability index, including from the UN, who has about two of them, and one for disaster reduction and then one for the development program. But you're going out the CDC model, deriving from census data, which, by the way, folks, explains how the Bureau of Statistics and Plans is involved in this. As some of you know, the Bureau of Statistics and Plan was in charge of the 2020 Census of Guam and is traditionally involved with the census. And we're in small part helping with Dr. Polino and her work here by providing data from the 2010 census, which is the only full census data available right now. Yes, the 2020 census was concluded. But the Bureau's role in that operation, which lasted more than a year, was only limited to the enumeration process, which means the process of going out and getting the forms filled out by the respondents and collecting them and then securing them. And then once that process is done, they're shipped all the census forms to Washington. And that's where they're tabulated and analyzed. The local census office does not actually do any analysis of the census data. We've been often contacted that based on that data we collected here any indication of this or any particular data point, and we've had to explain, well, we just went through the rather arduous process, and it took many months, particularly during COVID-19 crisis, to actually accumulate the data. But this is actually tabulated and, I said, analyzed by the U.S. Census Bureau, which is expected to release the data sets related to that, the 2020 census of Guam, over the next couple of years. We're told that by the summer we'll get the population and housing data, but we're also told informally not to hold them to it because we'll see how this proceeds. No doubt, Dr. Polino, then once that data comes in, it'll be made available to you for, to further inform your work.
Oh, wonderful. Yes, we would love to do that. As you mentioned, we're limited to the 2010 census data. And so what we're doing right now is we're really setting up this is sort of a pilot test for us. We're setting up all our formulas and our models so that when the 2020 data is released, then we can then apply the same calculations and get a more updated idea of any changes to the SDIs by the village as well as the CDPs.
Is your approach to developing the social vulnerability index, is this what is known as a demographic approach, or is this sort of different than what's otherwise?
It does incorporate the demographic information. So right now, the way the CDC method works is it's basing it off of four different themes. And so they include socioeconomic status, some of the household composition and disability, which seems reasonable because in natural disasters, you don't know what you want to have capture, how many people in the household, how many children are living in the household under the age of five, how many are disabled, because that would affect mobility. It also captures minority status and language, as well as housing type and transportation. For example, does the household have vehicles? Now, what we've done on our part is we've augmented the CDC methodology. So it's not going to be exactly the same as the CDC method, in that we've added three more themes to better reflect Guam's experiences. For example, if we stuck with the minority definition according to CDC, then the entire island would pretty much fall under that category. So we've adjusted that in our calculation, and we've also added some other variables that are more reflective of our local housing situation. For example, lack of public water, public sewer system, concrete building versus tin roofing. We also added some of the information on the connection, like whether or not they have battery-operated radios, access to computers or laptops, internet service. So we've added quite a few more of the variables from the census, the Guam census data, and we've used that to augment the CDC methodology. So we're actually going to be providing the estimate both ways, one using the CDC methodology and then the other one, an augmented version.
We're with Dr. Yvette Polino from the University of Guam, who is her and her colleagues are creating a social vulnerability index for Guam. If anyone has any questions on the subject, you can call in at 477-5757, 477-5757. We are broadcast live on News Talk K57 and on 96.5 FM, and our simulcast on pncguam.com and on k57.com, and is also streaming live at News Talk K57 on Facebook. We're also simulcast on GTA Channel 3 and Giacomo Channel 2. And a podcast of tonight's discussion will be posted online at kfd7.com and on over the next couple of days on the Bureau's three social media pages for the Bureau itself, for the Coral Reef Initiative, and also for the Guam Coastal Management Program. Dr. Polino here, is in your examination of creating the social vulnerability index, and also in physical structures as well, such as housing and utilities. I am assuming so. Those sort of aspects. To what degree do you also examine not just the characteristics of individual people or individual households, but their relationship with society and the nature of the relationship with their environment that they inhabit? How does that play any part in your particular way of constructing a social vulnerability index for Guam?
The way the model is structured right now, it doesn't lend itself to that. However, what we would like is for the community to be able to use the information to inform that. For example, with the forum that we're holding this coming Friday, we wanted to invite stakeholders who may be using the data and to help show how the data can be used for mm-hmm. that purpose. For example, if this is going to be used by the mayor's offices, and I forgot to mention, one of the things that we did was we actually broke it down further into the CDP level. So instead of just calculating the SVIs for all the villages, we've actually been able to stratify further by some of the areas within the villages, and we found that made a big difference. So for mayors that have multiple areas, CDPs within their villages.
Well, what's a CDP? Dr. Polino, just for the education of the illumination of the listening audience, what is a CDP?
I'm sorry. Thank you for asking that. I believe they're the census designated places.
Right.
So, for example, Dedido might be further broken down into a Stumbo, Ukudu, Machinau.
Right. And just if I could add to it there, what one of the things the census does in terms of producing its information here, it does not only break it down by municipal and territorial and state boundaries, but also what they identify as tracts with their own sort of features. Now, these tracts, by the way, are also the basis for a lot of other federal policies. Not the least of which is the federal opportunity zones, for which have tremendous tax breaks on capital gains for investment into given tracts that meet the standard regarding income levels within there and identified as investment deprived areas. And so those are the same tracts you're zeroing in on as well, Dr. Polino. Is that not the case?
Yes. Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with the financial application, but it sounds
right. But it's the basic sense of census track, though. It's used for a number of things, but yeah, that's and it's defined by, I believe, some of the demographic features of a given area, just to bring context to the data itself, as opposed to confine it to largely artificial boundaries of municipal, yes, and state and territorial entities. I'm sorry, Dr. Polino, you were saying.
Oh, thank you for that. Yeah, so what we're noticing is if we just look at SVI by the village, we may be missing some of the key elements within the larger villages. The example I gave earlier was Dedido. So if we just use Dedido as the marker to calculate our SVI, Dedido may not show up as one of the most vulnerable, villages on the island. However, when we break it down by the CDP level, the census designated place, then a particular area in Dedido will pop up as the most vulnerable area on the island.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see how that adds value in terms of better understanding pockets of vulnerable places within some of the villages in Guam.
Which is intensely useful considering a third of the population is in Dedido, and the degrees of mixes of neighborhoods there, they vary a great deal in terms of organization and density and the living standard and vulnerability to a number of things and constraints upon responsible growth, for particularly in areas of over the aquifer. Yeah, so that kind of detail breakdown is important. Go ahead, Dr. Polina, you were saying?
Oh, no, I agree with you.
Well, Dr. Polina, help me here. This is, so what is the purpose of your research for the Social Vulnerability Index? You're basing this on the CDC. So vulnerability to any disaster, or is it, and any pandemic, is that the idea, something that stresses the community or the society? Is that kind of the end goal of all this?
Yes, I think all of those, it's definitely a way to be able to better use, the disaster cycle. So if you're familiar with the disaster cycle, there's the preparedness phase, the response, the recovery, and then the mitigation. And I think in understanding the Social Vulnerability Index, in other words, where your particular area falls in terms of vulnerability, I think you can better employ these particular areas of the disaster cycle, which could mean, which areas to address first, what are the resources you would need to activate in order to get to some of these places that are vulnerable, in this case, because we're working at the village level as well as the CDP level, we're really looking forward to having some of the mayors or representatives from the mayor's offices participate in our forum.
Yeah, well, that would speak to the mitigation efforts. In other words, you know what's vulnerable, so you know what to quickly respond to. But, of course, it would inform other phases of the disaster cycle, in particular preparation. In terms of marshaling resources, or maybe taking, unless I misunderstood the term, unless taking steps to help build resiliency a disaster here. And speaking of resiliency, are you familiar with Dr. Romina King's work on climate change?
Yes, in fact, going through this process, it was brought to our attention that they had initiated the Social Vulnerability Index mm-hmm. calculations for Guam. And so we've connected with her. She's now a part of our group, and we are expanding on what they have done previously. It is through her group where we learned that there were other variables from the census data that were not included in the CDC model, and this time around with some of her and her colleagues' guidance, we are incorporating them.
So perhaps to explain to the listening audience how I'm involved with Dr. Romina King and her work here is that Dr. King is vice chair of the Governor's Climate Change Resiliency Commission, and she produced a an analysis of threats to the island regarding to climate change. And as part of that researcher, she created a social vulnerability index in terms of vulnerability to climate change. And Dr. King's work was presented last year at the 5th Annual Assembly of Planners Symposium, which is conducted every year by the Bureau of Statistics and Plans. And it was presented by Vanjie Luhan, the chair of the Governor's Climate Change Resiliency Commission, who stepped in for Dr. King, who had just given birth, you know, and, you know, chose to take care of her a newborn child, then come down to the Dusitani, go figure. So anyway, she was, Vanjie presented Dr. King's information there. And I go back to that subject here because one of the interesting aspects of her presentation, it was the correlations she came up with there in terms of judging what was the most vulnerable. And for a number of factors here, that one of the things that sort of influenced in terms of determining the level of vulnerability was not just only income strata, but to some degree ethnic makeup as well. Granted that ethnic makeup may in fact be a reflection of social strata, of income differentials or income inequality on the more extreme case here. But are you finding that aspect to be coming up? What stage in the process are you at? Am I asking a question that's too early in the process?
We just had a discussion on that today. It's a lot more complicated and perhaps needs more teasing out. But yes, we are seeing that ethnicity does play a role. Again, this is something that we're going to further explore to better understand the data. So in terms of our health insurance, one of the things that we plan on doing with the SVI is to try to apply the estimates to our local behavioral risk factor surveillance system data. So for those of you who are not familiar with the BRESIS, the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, this is sponsored by the CDC. It's also funded by the CDC, but it's an annual survey that's conducted through phone. So if you've ever received a telephone call on health information survey that is sponsored by the Department of Public Health and Social Services and the CDC, this is their annual data collection. So they collect so many different health variables. It's a way to monitor the health indicators of the island. And so what we're hoping to do is to use the SBI and apply it to that so we can better understand some of the health aspects of the vulnerability within our communities. That's something that we're exploring right now. And to return back to your inquiry about, you know, the role that ethnicity plays, this is where we're finding more and more that there could be a correlation there.
Right. Just to go back, because we're covering a number of aspects and operations here that don't want to get the audience lost in the way. This is a very complicated conversation.
Thank you for bringing me back.
Okay. Well, you know, this. You know, as I've explained in previous shows, one of the reasons why I do this show is to tackle very complicated subjects like the one, like your particular research, that doesn't always fit into a couple column inches of the newspaper or a 30-second signbot in the TV news, and provide a sort of a long-form process to examine it. I thought that would be of interest to people here, because one of the things I found when I got into the as the position of director of the Bureau of Statistics and Plans is what interesting stuff they did, almost geeky stuff they did, and there were people still out there who were actually interested in this. You know, so this is one way of sort of getting those issues getting them out here. But so going back to the public health survey, CDC survey here, I've had a lot of my plate last year in terms of surveys. In addition to the 2020 census of Guam, we were also in the process, in partnership with UOG, of conducting, or we were in the process of conducting, the household income and expenditure surveys before the COVID-19 shot a lot of down. So I sort of lost track of this survey. Has that already happened for this year, the public health CDC survey?
It's ongoing.
It's ongoing. Okay.
Yeah, it's done on a monthly basis, and I think it happens throughout the year.
Right.
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay, so then perhaps sort of walk us through here. How do you think the SVI, the Social Vulnerability Index, would better give a small example of how take a data set that comes out of the public health CDC survey, and maybe if you could sort of give an example as how the Social Vulnerability Index would inform that data, or would provide a means or a facility to better understand what that data actually means. Is there an example you can give us, perhaps?
Sure. The way we're thinking about it, and we're still trying to think this through, is that particularly with our CDC BRFSS data set, the one that I was referring to, village information is collected from the participants. So we would have the municipality. We wouldn't have the CDP level, but at least we would have the municipality.
Mm-hmm.
And so once we know that, then we can identify SVI index for that particular individual.
So in other words, you start with the SVI index and you apply it to that individual profile, so to speak.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And so we can do things like look at, for example, the obesity prevalence within the villages and look at whether that is related to the Social Vulnerability Index.
Mm-hmm.
There are other information like physical activity, fruit and vegetable intake, lots of information on whether they've been diagnosed with certain chronic conditions, smoking, vaping, sort of lots of different health, lifestyle behaviors and
mm-hmm.
health indicators that
mm-hmm.
are collected. So definitely a rich data set, and we want to see if we can fold the SVI into it. Since the data set also contains the municipality information.
So the key to this is the modeling thing, as opposed to a model that develops a sort of ranking order or a snapshot picture. What essentially the Social Vulnerability Index, and help me along, Dr. Polino, if I get this part wrong. It basically allows to get raw data from the public health CDC survey or any other survey or census data survey, and take that data into a model which would identify and perhaps even extrapolate vulnerabilities with respect to the impact of a disaster or pandemic or some other stressful event. Is that a fair way of putting it, or am I missing something?
I think that's how we hope to use the information.
Mm-hmm.
I guess a broader way to look at it is census data really provides more aggregate level information.
Right.
Whereas
right.
with the CDC BRFSS data set, they collect information on individuals
mm-hmm.
so that we can take that individual level data, apply the census aggregate level SVIs and perform an analysis that way. So.
But by the way, just to explain, it's regarding the 2020 Census of Guam. It's not as if that individual data is not available. However, a part of the census process is very, very strict. Federal controls on confidentiality, and as a matter of fact, the local census office, which is stationed in Timuning, in the old Docomo office, in the above Century at Century Plaza, that once constructed and operated was considered a Title 13, Title 13. I keep getting the titles wrong, but a federal secure facility, and protocols and procedures and how you where the forms are kept, and including stationing a security booth at the only main access into the offices. As I like to tell, the security procedures were so strict that even when I occasionally visited the census office to Mooning, I had to sign in and get a visitor's badge and be escorted throughout mm-hmm. the facility. That's because it had a federally protected data in terms of its confidentiality here. So, and in which case it feeds into the census data sets that are produced out of U.S. Census Bureau in Washington, which is I guess in contrast with the radio interviews, another radio is the telephone interviews, that even though you may not identify the person, at least you have access to those individual survey forms in order to feed into the profiles. Is that kind of how the how that works, Dr. Polino?
Well, there's a public use version that can be made available by mm-hmm. request through our local coordinator. So I believe they do have some, identifiable information, for example, their phone number, right, because that's how they would call them. But all of that is removed from the data set once provided upon request.
But unlike the census, at least the information on a granular level, even though identity is strictly redacted in order to prevent that process here, as opposed to not seeing the data until it is actually processed and produced in aggregate form. And I think that's one advantage of tapping that data as opposed to census data as with respect to your model, because you can sort of fine-tune it here. In determining, you mentioned some of the factors that would come out from the data sets from the CDC and Public Health survey here. What would it survey? It would certify location, it would certify sort of health background here. Would it survey environmental factors, like in terms of housing or I suppose you could cover economic factors to a certain degree, but that process incorporate information on environmental factors in the broad sense of the term, you know, environmental affecting sort of housing situation, probably even crime as well? I mean, is that the sort of thing that comes out through that survey?
It could. Mm-hmm. The survey is done every year. There's what's called a state edit module. So in the survey itself, there's a core that all the states and territories have to ask. But if every state and territory wanted to ask other questions that are relevant to their jurisdiction, then they request what's called a state edit module. Through there, you can ask questions that are more relevant to our local community. So I'll give you an example. When I was doing my work on betel nut, that's not of interest to the United States.
What work were you doing on betel nut?
So I actually added a state added version for the betel nut
questionnaire. I see.
Yeah. So we could, you know, if there was an interest in the environmental aspect, that can be requested through the state coordinator as an inclusion into the BRFSS. So I think that flexibility is very attractive. We were looking, and it's done every year. So what we're looking at right now is 2011, but we could have access to 2011 all the way to 2019 if we wanted. And we can also look at trend information. But I think that flexibility of adding questions that are relevant to your state is very attractive for anybody who's interested in utilizing this survey as a way to capture information related to their area of interest.
Yeah, let me interrupt you for one thing. Just you mentioned an acronym BRSF. What does that stand for?
Oh, okay, so that is the CDC health survey. It stands for Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System.
Well, going back to the subject of environment, I'm just going to throw this out there and get your response to it. Would crime statistics have any merit or value in terms of your social vulnerability index? Because there are crime statistics available, maybe not by census tract, but certainly by municipality. Does that have any impact at all? Or would that have any use at all?
Once we have the SBI for each of the villages, we could pretty much apply to any data set that can be broken down by the village.
Well, that's a matter of taking in the data sets to run through the model. Why does it not have any value in terms of constructing the model? I mean, in terms of
constructing the model.
Yeah.
The CDC model. I'm actually looking at it right now, and I don't think it has any of that.
Dr. Pliny, you see where I'm getting at. To the extent it has to do with environmental and social factors, you know, one of the obvious ones is crime. But I'm untutored in as to the intricacies of this sort of statistics at this level here. So, I'm just sort of proffering a question to see how you view that as something that is useful, or perhaps maybe can give some indication to why it doesn't quite fit into the process itself. Are you constrained by using the CDC model as your foundation for this analysis?
I believe it's because we have a model that's already been pilot tested. Not to say that we couldn't add that to it, but I think it's going to require more longer-term work, which may involve a combination of some qualitative as well as some quantitative data collection.
Right. So, in short, because the CDC model is not only an understandable model, but a road-tested model, because in any statistical process, there's always some quirk here and there that you never find out until you actually road test it. To the extent that you start adding stuff outside the model, you sort of detract of the value of having a road tested model. The more stuff you add in that hasn't been road tested, unless you actually do the really intense work of validating this little extra bit you need to add onto it. And of course, with any research project, there has to be some limitation of resources. At some point, you've got to stop fooling around the model and come up with something practical. You know, so I understand your perspective on this one. So, Dr. Pliny, moving forward, what can people expect? How your research will proceed? Coming up on, I believe this, you said this Friday is a meeting with stakeholders. Identify what for the listening audience. What do you mean by stakeholders? Give a few examples. You once mentioned mayors, but what other stakeholders could there be?
Basically, anyone who is involved with a natural hazard response, the response process. So we've invited the mayors, senators, people from Homeland Security, Environmental Protection Agency, some people from the University of Guam. You know, at this point, we are happy to open it to anybody who is interested in attending, but most importantly, we're hoping to obtain feedback on some of the things we've done and what the best way is to disseminate the information. Mm-hmm. We are limited to 50, the first 50 people to register to mm-hmm. attend, but this is an opportunity to share what we've done so far, provide some of our estimates, but I think more importantly, we want to know how we can share this information and to whom we should share this information so that it's something that is used by the community and not just something that's reported to the Natural Hazards Center.
Okay, I sort of have two questions here. One, is this an actual meeting or a virtual meeting?
It's virtual.
And where do people go, say, if they want to get to one of those prize 50 slots? How do they apply?
I have an email address that they can direct their interest to. The contact person is either Jade or Cassiera, but here's the email address. It's SVI for Social Vulnerability Index. Mm-hmm. So it's just SVI.guam@gmail.com.
Oh, excellent. And then my second question is that ultimately you're using this SVI for natural hazards. So this wouldn't necessarily apply to its relevance, say we got a missile from China.
Sorry, can you repeat that?
In other words, you mentioned that this is used for in order to gauge SVI or vulnerability for natural hazards. So does this mean that it would have limited application, say, for example, if we hit by a missile from China? hypothetically, obviously, but even though it's been in the papers, so you know, so. but just to clarify, what you're assessing vulnerabilities of, you know, is it natural disasters or man-made ones?
They can be both.
Okay.
So in the context of the Natural Hazard Center, and this is something that is fairly new to me because most of my work has really been in the health arena,
mm-hmm.
is that anything that falls under the Natural Hazard Center, by the way, this is supported by the Natural Hazard Center at the University of Colorado Boulder. So anything that falls under that jurisdiction would include, as I mentioned earlier, typhoons.
Is this a federal entity in Boulder? The Natural Hazard Center, is this a federal entity in Boulder? Or is it a state entity or is it a private one?
They are supported. So this particular project is supported by the National Science Foundation,
okay.
and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Okay.
However, I am also required to add that our findings and our opinions don't necessarily reflect that of the NSF, nor the CDC, nor the Natural Hazard Center.
I've been waiting for 45 minutes for you to get to that part. So have some familiarity with federal programs. So, after this Friday meeting with stakeholders, and we'll return back to give the contact information again, sort of paint for the picture for listening audience, how do you expect the rest of your research to unfold? I mean, in other words, what would be the next phase, so to speak? More outreach efforts, or how do you vision it unfolding?
So we still have a lot of work in terms of the application to the BRFSS. I think that's definitely going to help connect the health folks with the environmental. I mean, it really is, we're all connected,
mm-hmm.
But this is a way of reaching out to our non-traditional partners to show how we are connected. And so the way I see this playing out is really working towards the application of this to the BRFSS. We can use that information to better characterize our vulnerable communities. Once we have the SBIs, this is not the answer to all, because these SBIs are only based on the 2010 data set.
Tools
could change with the 2020 data set. And we are looking forward to continuing with the 2020 data set to see if there are any changes, and if so, we would have to adjust the application to the BRFSS. But being able to provide that information out, most especially those who respond to a natural disaster, mm-hmm. but also maybe bridge that connection from the environmental health folks or the environmental folks with the folks that do this type of work in the public health. So hopefully we can see more of that connection.
This is just
the beginning. but there's definitely still a lot of work that needs to be done.
Yes, I certainly hope you will have an opportunity to avail yourself. This is dependent on the speed in which the U.S. Census Bureau gets out the data sets. I, for one, certainly hope you will be able to, in the process of your research, to avail yourself extensively of the 2020 census data sets when they come out here. For those of us who have been watching this process for a while here, there's been a concern among many about the data sets produced by the 2010 census, and that there may have been an undercount of Guam's population, because the numbers that came in were surprised many as lower than expected here. Now, understand, the U.S. Census Bureau has validated the 2010 census, so I'm not trying to detract from the veracity. But these data sets coming out of the 2020 census is being looked at with great anticipation, with a number of sources, not the least of this is Dr. Polino and her colleagues dealing with the social vulnerability index. Dr. Polino, sometimes when you have models or functions here that deal with social vulnerability, that term, and to the extent that people understand it, is this also a means of, say, of sort of recognizing the marginalized in society here, who not always, classic example is the homeless, who as a society we sort of put out of our mind, even though we know intellectually it exists here, but of a way of sort of giving voice or painting a substantial picture of those who are the most marginalized society and people would think are the most vulnerable. Is that one way of looking at this, or am I being overly philosophical?
It may be a marker.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those spaces, it may be a marker for some of those, the situation and living conditions that you're referring to. This may be a marker of some of that, especially if they're being captured or if they were captured in the 2010 census data. Not that really familiar with how the homeless population works in terms of capturing that in the census.
Well, there is in the 2010 census there is a homeless count. What happens is that people are sent out it's part of the group quarters count. So they're sent out to places where the homeless gather. And that's incorporated in that process. And on an annual basis, the Guam Homeless Coalition, this is a mix of NGOs and government agencies, including the Bureau of Statistics and Plans, does its own count, which is sort of basically required for a number of federal grants that come in to attend to the homeless. But I was mostly speaking of, people passing the homeless in the street or begging and other stuff, and they sort of, there's this tendency to sort of blot out of your mind and not kind of focus on it there, as a way of dealing with it as a many daily fact of life. And I know again, I may have indulged in too much philosophy here for what is basically a statistical research project. But anyway, that's what I was kind of alluding to it. Dr. Polino, we're heading down for the last 7.5 minutes of this segment here. And this is the part of the program where I sort of turn it over to a guest on the assumption that I've been talking too much, and to give you a chance to leave the listening audience with whatever final comments or import whatever information you're going to do. By the way, I forgot to ask, how exactly is your research funded? Is there a grant for this?
So this was made possible through the Natural Hazards Center at the University of Colorado Boulder.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's through their Research Award Program, which is supported by the National Science Foundation and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Mm-hmm. And again, as a reminder, I'm obligated to emphasize that our findings, our opinions, and anything that we do present on Friday does not reflect the ideas and the thoughts of the Natural Hazards Center, the NSF, or the CDC.
Nor does the philosophical perspective of the interviewer of people involved in the grant. So thank you so much for seizing on that leading question. I wanted to get that part in here. But again, the mic is yours to whatever information or comments you want to impart to the listening audience or where they can go again. You maybe mention your email again for the SVI program, Social Vulnerability Index program, in these last few minutes before we head up to the 7 o'clock radio news with CBS.
Absolutely. So again, we are holding the stakeholder forum on Friday, that is March 26th at 12 o'clock. It'll be held virtually. We're hoping to take the first 50 people who register. You may contact via email our team at sbi.guam@gmail.com. I'll also give you a number that might be easier for some of the listeners, 797-0491, and just let them know you're interested in registering for our forum this Friday.
Okay. Fantastic. By the way, Dr. Polino, when you're not doing this, what sort of work do you do at the University of Guam?
I teach at the University of Guam.
there we go. Yeah, my wife has done that, and is going to do some of that in the summertime. So yes, so certainly valuable work as well, regardless whether there's a pandemic or not.
Yes, Yes, and thank goodness for our virtual platform.
Yes, absolutely. By the way, I forgot. I forgot to ask. How long do you think your research will take?
You know, the process, the calculations itself does not take long. It's really waiting for the data. So, the one we're currently working on, we hope to complete this by the end of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's, as I mentioned earlier, this is just the first step, and there's so much more that we need to do. And the team is super excited. We're actually looking forward to the release of the census data. And then we can correspond that with the release of the 2020 or 2021 BRFSS data. So we know that there's still a lot of work ahead, and I hope the team stays motivated because we're very excited about what we're seeing, but we're even more excited about the future possibilities.
Not to mention the fact that the U.S. Census Bureau will probably take 2 years to get all their data sets, so you have a long time waiting for the most current information. So patience as well as perseverance will have to be your watchwords, I think, throughout this progress. Dr. Vetpolino, thank you so much for joining us this evening. I think it's been a very interesting discussion, even for those listening in, and taking time to explain an important research project going on that has real relevance to Guam's preparedness for the impacts of natural disasters and how we respond not just as individual entities, but as a community. So thank you very much, Dr. Polino. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope that we will have some people join us for our gathering on our virtual gathering on Friday.
Well,
thank you so much.
There will at least be one representative from the Bureau of Statistics and Plans, I expect. So again, thank you very much, Dr. Polino. That's Dr. Vetpolino.
You're welcome.
Thank you. That's Dr. Vetpolino from the University of Guam, who and her colleagues are working on development of a social vulnerability index for the island to gauge vulnerabilities due to a natural disaster. We're coming to the end of the program. As said, next Tuesday we'll have on David De La Sala, Director of the Department of Labor, to explain what the recent American Rescue Plan means for the PUWA program. Some of that has been reported in the news, but you know, one thing David and many others involved in dealing with these federal assistance programs have found is that you never really find out all the details until you get the specific written advisory from the agency administering the program in D.C., in this case the U.S. Department of Labor. And so, like many other people, we have followed the process of developing the American Recovery Plan and read the news articles about it, but the proof in the pudding is when the U.S. Department of Labor says, well, this is how this is going to work. And by this point here, David is confident we have received the full import of it, of advice from the U.S. Department of Labor, and be able to speak authoritatively about this in the coming days, and certainly next Tuesday here on the Data Hub with me, Tyrone Titano. We're here every Tuesday from 6:30 to 8. Please join us next Tuesday as we head up towards the 8 o'clock CBS Radio News. And where we'll probably go to the music of Fisher. Let's see what the booth does. Either Fisher Spooner or New Order. Both bands from my distant youth. So thank you, everybody. Thanks for joining us. See you in a week.
K57 is 570 AM KGUM, Hagatnya, Guam.